Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Daddy! 4-year-old Corey was wailing from his room. His dad dragged himself out of bed and shuffled down the hall to see what was the matter. It's a monster! Corey whimpered, pulling the covers up around his neck. And he's hiding right there! He pointed to his closet door. Daddy, make him go away! From a parent's perspective, what are the issues our children tackle in the years from 3 to 6? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. We're in for a special treat today as our guests are internationally recognized experts here to help us understand 3 to 6-year-olds. Dr. T. Barry Brazelton, Clinical Professor of Pediatrics Emeritus at Harvard Medical School and Professor of Pediatrics and Human Development at Brown University, has dedicated his life to helping children and their parents. He has established Touch Points centers in more than 30 communities in 21 states. He's a famed advocate for children and their parents and has written books that have sustained parents through their child rearing for several generations. Dr. Brazelton has 4 grown children and 6 grandchildren. Welcome, Dr. Brazelton.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Joshua Sparrow is Dr. Brazelton's close colleague in the National and International Touchpoints programs. A child psychiatrist, he is supervisor of inpatient psychiatry at Children's Hospital in Boston, on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, and associate director of training at the Brazelton Touchpoint Center at Children's Hospital. He has a daughter and a son. We're so glad to have you with us, Dr. Sparrow.
Thank you for having us.
What developmental differences are most noticeable in children who just turned 3 and those who are almost 7? Those are the 2 extremes in your new Touchpoints book.
Gosh, there's so much that goes on in those years that is so exciting. And the developmental issues that come to fruition in those years, I think, are really what we got caught up with. As you can see, it's a pretty big book. I think a three-year-old is just becoming aware of the world around him and the fact that he can have an effect on it. And it's the opportunity to bring a conscience into play, to begin to feel I can affect the world, so I have a responsibility toward the world. Altruism begins then, and they care about whether they make it with other people or not. One of my grandchildren went up to this lady with a lot of makeup on her face, and he said, "Do you paint your face?" I nearly died. And she took the time to answer him. She said, "Yes, I do. Otherwise, people wouldn't even look at me." And he came away from her and he said, "She's a nice lady." She explained it to me. And I thought, you know, this is talking about how this little boy really realized he'd made a boo-boo and insulted her in a way. But in another way, she lived right up to it. And he wanted to model on it. And I thought that was just glorious. And this sort of thing in a 3-year-old, I think, is what surprises people, that there's so much going on in addition to the tantrums they have to put up with, but also the plea for limits that comes up. And by 7, most of those things are really pretty much in place and are ready to go for going to school, being ready to be presented to the world, which is what going to school is. And I guess there's just an enormous gap in there. We call it second chances because the first 3 years are so important that I think people are aware of that now. But this period we think of as sort of the second chance, you know, to think about what you've been doing and how much more shaping you can really be effective at.
How can parents help their children with nighttime fears?
I guess I would start by understanding what they mean to a child who is 4 or 5. And at 4 or 5, a child has this new capacity to be aware of a wish to be powerful, to exert an effect on the world, to be strong and strong-willed, and even to be aggressive, even to be angry. But the difference between the 4-year-old and the 2-year-old is that a 4-year-old already has some concerns about being angry and has some sense that being angry isn't approved of and gets worried about it. So the four-year-old takes these angry feelings that are a little scary for him to bed with him at night and then dreams them into the monsters and witches who are angry and threatening him. And so I think if a parent begins by understanding that that is the process that leads to nighttime fears, it makes it easier to sit by the side of the bed and to listen to the story from beginning to end. And I think if you let a child tell you absolutely everything that happened in that bad dream, they're a whole lot less likely to have that dream again, because what you've shown them is that you're there and you'll make sure that they're okay. And not just that they're protected from the witches and monsters that you can go looking for under the bed and in the closet, but that you will also be there to protect them from their own angry feelings, because your role as a parent is to teach them how to control and manage those feelings.
I think there's some other things that parents can do, too, about these nightmares and fears, because this is absolutely universal. And parents get all frightened about it because they don't understand this connection that Josh made. I would certainly take it seriously enough to look under the bed, look in the closet, and be sure that they weren't there, and to value the child's anxiety and fear at the time. But I'd also look for some other things. During the day, when the child gets angry or aggressive and does not act out, pick them up and say, "That was wonderful. Look what you did. You kept yourself from getting out of hand. This is really great." And then when you, as a model, don't get carried away by your anger, like driving and you miss somebody or something like that, point it out to the child, because this gives them a chance to model on you too, so that they can learn about aggression and anger as a safe thing and in a safe way. And I think that's one of the ways that children may learn the quickest.
We still have the joke in our house. My oldest son didn't want his two little brothers in his room, so he told them there was a man in the closet. And to this day, they don't like to stay in his room because they know that man is in the closet, and they're grown-ups. Isn't that funny?
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on 3 to 6-year-old children.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow about raising 3 to 6-year-olds. What should we be doing about lying and tattling? Do we handle these problems differently for 3-year-olds than we do for 6-year-olds?
Well, I guess I would start by having a parent stop and thinking about what it is about the lying and tattling that worries them so much, that bothers them. Because with all of the pressure that we feel to do the best job we can for our children and to be perfect parents, which of course we can't be, I think we look at a lot of behaviors like this and think, oh my God, I've done something terrible. My child's going to turn out to be a sociopath or something. And instead, having put aside those worries, to look at what it means for the child. And certainly a 3-year-old who lies because the real world is for the moment absolutely intolerable to them. And their wish for the real world to be something different than what it really is so strong that their lie almost seems like it's real to them in that moment. And so when you understand that that's why they need to lie, because they're having such a hard time putting up with whatever part of reality isn't acceptable in that moment, then you can see that our job is to help them face the frustration or the sadness about the world having to be the way it is, and to expect that once we do that, we will get an expression of frustration and sadness and perhaps temper tantrums in a way they're protecting against that with the lying.
But Josh, can't you still add, you know, you and I both know you're not telling the truth, and I don't like it when you lie to me. I can understand it, but I don't like it. So that you put some limits on that are real. I think of lying and stealing as sort of like play in a child's, when it it occurs at the right ages, that they're trying out the world to see if they lied, would it turn out the way they wanted? If they stole mommy's dress and put it on, and even if they put their foot through it, would it make them look like mommy? And these are the kind of fantasies that I think we don't want to squash in our kids. We do want them to come out, as Josh says, as something that we can tolerate. But at the same time, I think you can say, you know, when you do this without my helping you into this dress, you really wrecked my dress. I can't tolerate that. And put some limits on it so it becomes an opportunity both for tolerating it, but also for saying, this is as far as you can go with it.
Using those I messages, you know, I feel, I don't like.
Oh, I think you got to, don't you?
Yeah.
We didn't talk about tattling, which is a different story. Tattling is different from lying. I think lying for young children is really about wishing that the world could be different than it is and having trouble facing the world the way it is. Tattling is really, I think, learning about social relationships and putting me first, so that when a child tattles, the purpose is not to accomplish something for the child who is being tattled on. The purpose is for the child who is doing the tattling to get in good with the adults that they're telling the story to. And so the goal for the parent is to help the child recognize that they can shift the way they handle the situation into one that actually would be helpful to the child who is being tattled on. For example, you know, I'm really glad that you told me about this, but do you think you could get this child to tell me this himself? So that ultimately your goal is for the child to be able to think about another person's needs and to act on behalf of another person's needs.
There have been several articles recently about the clarifying the difference between tattling and telling.
And telling? What do you mean by that?
What I've read is you're teaching a child to tell accurately what he thinks he has seen or heard, but not to go, nah, you know, so-and-so did this, I'm going to get so-and-so in trouble. There's a difference in attitude.
And the distinction is really whether it's self-serving or serves the other child, because certainly you can see adolescents who will go to an adult to say, I'm really worried about my friend. I think she might have an eating disorder, or I'm afraid that she might try to kill herself. And there, they are not doing it to ingratiate themselves with the adult. They're doing it because they genuinely want to help the other child, and that's the goal that you're trying to shift a tattling child towards.
I think a lot of it has to do with content. If it's a significant content, I mean, you know, so-and-so, you know, made a mess on the floor or something, well, that's not the fault of the kid who's discussing it. So a lot of it may have to do with content.
But this brings me back to just what the book is all about, that surface behavior always has more underneath it. And so just to pay attention to surface behavior like tattling or telling is not the issue. Telling, you could see, is trying to define for yourself what the world's all about. And tattling is to get at somebody else or something like that. So I think this is where parents really get lost and confused and frightened. Oh my gosh, I can't tell the difference. When the truth is, you can. Mm-hmm. You can look at the child and tell in a minute which it is.
What kinds of family and household chores are children ready for in this age range? We figure it's time to give them a little bit of responsibility, but what's appropriate?
Well, I feel like it ought to start long before this. I really think kids in the second year are ready to start being part of the family. And it may take you twice as long to let a child help you set the table with plastic plates or to do the dishes or whatever. But gosh, it's such an experience of feeling part of a working, overworked family that I would recommend it seriously. And what I always say to working mothers is save up energy so when you walk in the door, everybody's going to fall apart. You know that. And so gather them all up and get close. Don't go off and do chores at that point. Get close first and then take the kids with you to do your chores and let them help. Let them know that they're part of this family. And then by 3 to 6, they're really into that and they're ready for things like a family meeting every week in which you assign chores and assign the things that people want to do, but the things that they may not want to do, and also set some limits on them. If you don't do them, what happens? And but the whole family decides this together. I think one of the things that this is aimed at is getting families back together, even though they may be pulled apart by their jobs and stresses and so forth.
I remember my first call to a poison control center was when one of my children was helping to wash the dishes and was standing on a chair, you know, washing with soap and a brush and everything. And then I saw him take a cup and taste what he was washing. Oh, my God, I've poisoned my child, you know. And the poison control center said, you know, well, how much soap did he drink? Well, he took a sip from a cup. They told me not to worry about it too much. But it was, I always found the chores that the little children liked and the bigger children involved water or some kind of sprayer or what you could be making a mess with, but maybe it could be helpful. We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on 3 to 6-year-old children.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow about their new book, Touchpoints 3 to 6. We had one child who was very unhappy one day when my husband and I said, look, we're both very busy with work right now. Maybe you could find a project to do. So he did. He found a project. We have a room on the back of our house with sliding glass doors, all sliding glass doors. He cleaned them. We'll never know what he cleaned them with, but we could not see out of them. We couldn't see out of them afterwards, but he came up and said he's finished his work now.
But I think that that's the whole point, is that at this age, chores for a child will not be about making it easier for parents, and it may very well make it harder in the short term. But I think in the long run, it'll make it easier for everybody, because what you're giving to a child when you give them a chore is a sense of their purpose, of the contribution they can make to the family's well-being. And I think if you can start that early and continue it all the way through, it'll be a whole lot easier in adolescence when some of the testing that goes on is about, well, what really is our relationship about? Is it just about using your credit card to buy gas? Or just a place to come and get fed? And so if you can create the sense of a purpose in contributing to the family's well-being from the very beginning, I think in the long run it'll spare you headaches, even if it's a lot of work between the ages of 3 and 6. Yeah. Yeah. And I feel the same way about allowances, actually. I think the trouble with an allowance as payment for providing a service at this age is really saying that people get paid for doing things for the family instead of saying we do things for each other because we are a family. Now, allowances do serve other purposes, like beginning to understand about money and putting things away and organizing things and keeping track of things, but that's a very different message.
One thing we're convinced of is that these ages of 3 to 6 are like a map, and if you took this map to adolescence, you'd see exactly the same things going on, right, straight along. So it's almost like layering, getting a layer ready for the next big stressful stage of adolescence. And so the sort of things you lay down in here, like responsibility and like being part of the family and caring for that role, caring for your own role in it, becomes an opportunity to revive later on.
I found out I fell down on the job. I never taught my children to set the table. I just told them to put the things on the table, but I never really cared where they put them or how. Mm-hmm. And my middle son, as a grown-up, was asked by a lady friend to set the table. Suddenly dawned on him he really didn't know where things were supposed to be. He'd eaten in restaurants many times, but it was done for him. So he said to me, Mom, you never taught us to set a table. Right. So there's a suggestion.
Yeah, that's great.
Would you tell us a little more about Touchpoints 3 to 6?
Well, I think we regressed ourselves back to my first book, Infants and Mothers, with the concept that if we could get different temperaments in children, to go through the same things in different ways, then parents could see themselves and see their children a little bit more clearly. So we took four kids in the first part of the book and let them go through all the same things. And the four were necessary because the two in the middle are the normal, average, or whatever you want to call them, kids. One little girl and one little boy.
I think they're all normal, actually. and that we were trying to represent how wide the range of normal is.
That's right. And the two tails that he says are normal are the
that
ones
we
that
say
really drive parents up the wall. My first child was like this very shy, quiet, withdrawn child that just was so hard. And you just want to push him out of being shy in our culture. And yet to see how much it costs that child to take in information and put it together and socialize and all, I think is a very big gift to the parent or to the child of one like that. The other is the very active, hyperactive child. And I think parents don't see these kids as normal, but we wanted to show them that they were.
Because the range is very big. Yeah.
The range is big.
And I think it's also important to say that the purpose of having four different children is to help parents look for their child and their own experiences and their own families and to identify with them. But that sometimes parents won't, and they may not feel as if any of these children really captures who their child is. And that's really our shortcoming. And doesn't mean that a child isn't normal just because we failed to capture them in this book.
Well, I think a problem with parenting is we know how we react to mm-hmm. different things and how we did react when we were younger. But it's very hard to put ourselves in the shoes, as you were saying, Barry, of a child who reacts so differently, like mm-hmm. a shy child or a very outgoing child,
right.
Or just the opposite.
And you're always in your mind being judged by society. Will they accept my child? Will they accept me?
My response to this book and what I've read in it is that each of my children would probably overlap categories. And mm-hmm. I saw it that way. I didn't feel that you were imposing on us, fit your kid into one of these four molds.
Good.
I didn't feel that way at all. My reaction was, well, I know my children have characteristics from several of these mm-hmm. categories now that they're grown-ups. Of course, it's very easy to look back. But I think when you're going through it and when parents are looking at this book and reading it and consulting it, they need to understand that you're not trying to peg any child into one slot.
That's right. That's very important. So in each of the first four chapters, we talk about some events for the three-year-old and then the four-year-old and the five-year-old and the six-year-old for each of these four children. And we tried to give it a little bit of narrative excitement by intimating that there might be marital trouble for one family and that there was some other difficulty brewing for another child so that you could follow what happens to each child and family all the way through.
To get to the end to see what happens in the end.
Hope so. Hope somebody will read all the way through. The last half of the book we call Facing the Challenges of a Family, and we go through things like adoption, asthma, attention deficit hyperactivity, and birth order, food problems, all these things that parents run into and that I think they need help with. So we give our points of view about how you would handle each of these in a more succinct way so that they can put their finger on it, maybe.
That sounds very, very parent-friendly, which is what we all need at this point. We want to thank Dr. T. Barry Brazelton and Dr. Joshua Sparrow, authors of Touchpoints 3-6, for joining us today and helping parents everywhere to learn to deal with their 3-6-year-old children. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's fun to be with you and to hear your thinking.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and tell us what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning in from. Washington, D.C. with Kids and Parents as Mentors are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about us and our books, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.